Talk given Sunday, 20th October, 1974. We all know from our own daily experience in the world, with its pressures and with its disturbed state, how difficult it is to be mindful throughout the day, throughout the waking day. But if we have had opportunities to look into this, we may have noticed that if there is a relaxation of the body, then mindfulness becomes a little bit easier. This is one of the advantages of going through a review of the day when one goes to sleep. Go backwards in time, so to say, till we come to the beginning of the day. It is as if it were mindfulness by hindsight in a state of ease. Now this has very great advantages. It gives us a more dispassionate view of what has gone before. Being mindful in the immediate present is often in our lives in the city, is often attended with such stress and strain that the deeper purposes of mindfulness get defeated, or if not defeated, at least they are inhibited. But at night, when the body is steadily relaxing and one is going to sleep, if one dwells in mind quietly and peacefully without making any special effort to remain awake and make sure that you're going right through the day, if at that time one looks backward slowly, one will see things in a different perspective. And this mindfulness by hindsight, with the body getting more and more relaxed, will often call up deep things out of the hidden recesses of the mind, which are most valuable as a self-revelation. Sometimes you will find that this practice may bring unexpected flashes of illumination. It is useful to have pencil and paper by your bedside. I've done this myself, and occasionally some really worthwhile things emerge and you can record it and use it for quite a time at least. But there are certain things which are of great importance in connection with the practice of mindfulness, whether in terms of this particular method of mindfulness, this mindfulness by hindsight when you review the day, as well as in our ordinary daily mindfulness. We often deceive ourselves that we were quite mindful of this, that, or the other. The conscious mind is awake to the fact that one is attending mindfully. But there is a great deal behind the conscious mind, deep down in the subconscious. All our ordinary drives, desires, ambitions, and so on are at work all the time. In addition to that, there are all the unworked out mental impressions of our whole past, the great heap of vasanas, to use the term used in the Upanishads, the substrates for rebirth, as the Buddha called them, which are in the well of the unconscious, sunk in the well of the unconscious. There are all these forces at work. And these mental impressions, and unworked out, that is to say, not fully worked out when the event took place, all these are a storehouse of frustration, of resentment, of fear, confusion, and so on. There is a vast heap of evil collected down there. Psychological dirt, mud, if you like. Now, we mustn't apply the idea, let sleeping dogs lie, to this situation. Or the adage, don't stir up the mud. This mud has to be stirred up. It has to be worked out. Otherwise, there is no purification going on. And mindfulness does this. Our conscious mindfulness, which deceives us into believing that we are being rightly attentive, is vitiated by all these forces in the subconscious, our natural drives and desires and ambitions and so on, plus all these unworked out impressions. So that when we think, when we imagine, I should say, that we are paying right attention, the fact is that our attention is not wholly right. Because if there are any influences conditioning that attention, then we do not perceive the whole truth. That should be obvious, shouldn't it? We are looking at something, we are attending to it, we are being mindful about it from a particular standpoint. Take an example in ordinary everyday life, some trivial thing if you like. You're walking down a street, and perhaps you have some specific purpose to observe what sort of hats are being displayed in the shop windows. Well, now, we believe that we are looking dispassionately, quite objectively, at all these hats, and seeing each hat for exactly what it is. But are we? All our likes and dislikes, our preferences, our aesthetic tastes and so on, our reactions to the price which is put on the hats, all that is at play. Some of it we are aware of, but a great deal of it we are not aware of, which is all hidden in the well of the unconscious. I have given a very trivial, a trite instance. But is not this the kind of thing that happens when we attend to something? Now take a more serious situation. Somebody is introduced to us. How do we attend to him straight away? How do we meet him or try to meet him? The sense impression conveyed to us by his appearance, his voice, the way he is dressed, his manner of walking, sitting down, talking with you, or being shy, or whatever it is, all that is being continuously judged by what we are ourselves. And surely we cannot claim that we are free of any defects, and therefore what we see, what we hear, what we observe will be the exact truth of that person. Now, under those circumstances, the right relationship between him and me cannot take place. Which means that love in its reality, or if you like to put it impersonally, philosophically, human brotherhood, human unity, the unity of life, all these lovely sounding phrases, they are not functioning freely. The relationship is spoilt, and it is spoilt inevitably because I am blind from within. I am in a darkness from within because of all the accumulation in my own subconscious mind and in this deep well of the unconscious in which so many things have been unworked out. So that the meeting is not a pure meeting. It is not a whole meeting. Now, how then am I mindful of that particular experience, meeting John Smith? I cannot be mindful in the truly mindful way, can I? As a result of all that is in the subconscious and in the unconscious, my own brain is chattering away at the person who has been introduced to me all the time, non-stop. One has to observe that, how one is saying, oh, I'm very pleased to meet you, do sit down, will you, would you like a cup of tea, etc., etc., all the conventional modes of genteel behavior when one is introduced to a person. All that is going on externally But what is the brain saying quietly to itself all the time, at the same time? He's got a loud tie on, hasn't he? But why on earth doesn't he so-and-so? Or I wonder where he comes from. And it seems to me, oh, he's an awfully nice chap. Isn't he attractive and handsome and charming? And you see how the brain's chattering away? And when people of opposite sexes meet, the thing becomes a great drama. This is the funny part of our life, as well as it has its undertone of grey shades, shall we say. But you see, the depth and meaning of mindfulness, if we consider this slowly, quietly, we will see that this word mindfulness, not a very short word admittedly in the English language, but if you use the Pali sati, it's a very short two-syllabled word. This thing called sati is an enormous thing with immense consequences, with immense scope and immense implications. Now why, you may have noticed that certainly for the whole of this year practically, I've been talking of mindfulness. But I hope you see more and more why we have to consider this matter over and over again from every possible angle and go into as deep a depth as we can with regard to this question of mindfulness. Because mindfulness is the supreme instrument of purification. And this purification is not merely a cleaning out of the dirt. It's not like taking the plates and the knives and the forks after dinner and washing them up. It's not just that. Purification in that sense. It is partly purification in that sense, but that is the smaller part of it. It is purification in the sense that it makes the livingness of the being really function. We are not alive, we are more than half dead all the way through. Because, consider, these drives in us, desires and ambitions, these frustrations, resentments, confusions, fears, which are all stored up, are all corpses that we carry. They are the corpses of the past. We are like, especially if we are religious minded and attempting to live the religious life, this would apply very well indeed. We are like a church graveyard. The building, the church, represents our religiousness, and the graveyard with all the dead people buried there represents all the corpses that we carry within ourselves. Now you see, this is what prevents us from emerging out of subhumanity into true humanity, and which prevents the immaturity of our own minds from reaching maturity. Mindfulness is the means by which all these drives, desires, ambitions, those are the sort of positive forces on the one hand, and the whole heap of stored up resentments, fears, and so forth, on the other hand, how they all prevent us. Mindfulness enables us to change all that. Also, seeing these things with regard to the nature of mindfulness, we are, to use a rather a difficult phrase, we become mindful of mindfulness, of the nature of our mindfulness, and thereby we see more and more clearly what is implied, and therefore the faculty of mindfulness grows within one. You may find that there are so many who earnestly try to practice this mindfulness, and they deceive themselves they are practicing it. What are two of the very important forces inside us which allows us to remain self-deceived? They are vanity and egoism. Oh, I'm a good fellow. I'm such a nice fellow. That's my vain belief about myself. And my egoism, which is, oh no, I do know what I'm about. Do I? A frightful self-conceit. These are two very powerful forces which keep us, imprison us in this state of self-deception with regard to whether we are truly mindful or not. You will notice that in the attempt to practice mindfulness, sometimes we are totally and utterly defeated. We are caught up in a mood or a swirl of emotion. Usually, if we are going through some sort of fantasy in our own minds, we are caught up in that swirl, and since we have been practicing mindfulness for the last 2 days or 2 years or 20 years, if you like, you see, the word mindfulness keeps coming up, and we say to ourselves, oh, I must be mindful about this. I must really practice mindfulness and be free from this horrid swirl and this awful turmoil that is going on in my psyche. But that is a mistake. What am I doing? I'm calling upon mindfulness as if it was some power or entity I can call upon to aid me to get rid of my swirl. My ego has been offended that I could descend to this. My vanity is hurt. And it wants, and of course the sheer discomfort of it wants me to get rid of it. This wanting to get rid of the painful and the evil is the way of the world. It is not the way of the religia. Now, listen carefully. The religia will also take all the steps necessary to be free of the evil, the pain. But, in addition, the religia will be wholly concerned with trying to understand this pain, this upset, and learn the lesson out of it. Everything, pleasant and painful alike, has a lesson to teach us. And the religious person is the one who is learning the lesson which any experience has for him. Any and every experience through the day. And what he has to learn will be that which is related to the fruition of his religiousness. That is to say, the purification of his psyche, the purification of his mind, which will bring about freedom from all delusion and illusion, and of his heart, which will bring about freedom from greed and resentment and ill will and so forth. You see, there are so many people, earnest, well-meaning, sincere people, who very easily deceive themselves. That is to say, they allow themselves to get deceived, perhaps because they've got some bright idea in their minds. And being deceived, self-deceived, they think, oh, I'm on the road, on the right road. They may even believe, we are the enlightened ones. This is an extraordinary deception. A judgment passed upon oneself or upon another that I or he is thus and thus is a conclusion. And a conclusion is a fixed idea. Psychologically, it is dead psychological matter. Because the psyche is a living thing. It's alive all the time. A conclusion is a fixation. Whatsoever is a fixation is dead, psychologically. Where the body is concerned, it is slightly different. Not altogether different, but it's slightly different. The bone structure of the body, for example, is a fixed thing, as we say. Outwardly, it's a fixed thing. But the cells of the bones are alive. They are changing, therefore. Chemical processes going on all the time. If you don't take enough calcium, your bones begin to suffer, don't they? Or vitamin D, or whatever it is, and so forth. So that even with the bones, solid as they seem, they are undergoing change. And is this change in line with life, or is it something which is destructive of pure life? And it's the same with mindfulness. The way we can understand whether we are being rightly mindful, whether we are free from self-deception that we are mindful, and so forth, is to be wide awake and perceive whether this is in line with life itself, without ever defining precisely what the lines of life are. We have a general sense of it. Trust your general sense, your horse sense. It will take you out of the wood. When the rider has lost his way and he leaves, lets the reins go, and the horse somehow takes him out of the wood. The horse sense is better than the human sense there. Now, this sort of thing can happen with us also in our spiritual life. You must let this spiritual horse, your Pegasus, make the flight into the unknown, the Empyrean. And this is one of the very important aspects of mindfulness. And it marks a peak point, a climax of the practice of mindfulness. That out of the limited mindfulness which we experience in our ordinary sense life and with our intellectual mental processes, our discursive logical processes, all that gets transcended and the mindfulness becomes transcendent suddenly. It becomes infinite, utterly pure light, transcendent. You will find that under those conditions, the intensity of your mindfulness will not tell you anything specific. If it tells you something specific and you treasure it, well, that again is a burden which you bear. It is a fixation. If it does tell you, and if one has the wisdom to listen to what is being told in the immediate moment and let it pass by, from moment to moment, life is a continuous stream of revelation, right down at the level of thought and speech, which is the lowest level of functioning that we have. There comes the point when mindfulness becomes so perfect, so intense, that although you're awake, although you're moving through the world of things, although your eyes and ears and touch and everything, all your senses are functioning perfectly, at the same time you do not see the object or hear the sound or feel the touch, etc. Now this, to the ordinary man of the world, sounds a little bit queer. He thinks, this is one of those people who's a bit not all there. The fact of the matter is that a person who has sensibly gone along these lines is more than all there. He is also totally here. This is something which has to be experienced. The perfected Holy One will walk along with unerring skill. He won't barge into the next tree or jump into a thorn bush or knock the bus over which is coming along on the road. He will move with perfect skill, and at the same time he will be so intensely mindful, so transcendently mindful, that all these things as things will not be there. You see what has happened? That intensity of mindfulness has released the state of pure communion, absolute communion. He is so at one with the totality of things that his life movement can never strike a disharmonious note in the total life movement. You know, when we look out into space, especially at night, see the stars, the galaxies, tiny little dim-looking things in the distance, and they're all moving freely in space. It is true, we know intellectually through our science that collisions take place, mighty galactic collisions take place, explosions take place. We do know that through our scientific knowledge. And yet, what we have seen, what we have learned, makes us regard all this as a cosmos, as a manifestation of extraordinary order and beauty and pattern and so forth, don't we? We do that. We are aware of this order, which seems to be inherent in the natural life process of the entire cosmos. Now, with the perfected Holy One, with mindfulness reaching that transcendent peak, we too move through our little sphere on this earth, our little life in that manner. You see the implications of this. Around us, there are other potential enlightened ones. But oneself, having realized perfect mindfulness, moves amongst them, interplays with them in such a perfect manner that nothing evil, nothing wrong ever takes place. But this state of mindfulness, the capacity for this type of mindfulness implies then the utter purification of the psyche, the utter purification of mind and heart. Because when that is pure, no evil can come into me and touch me and sully me. No evil can be generated by me, out of me, and sully the world. Now, consider this in relation to our world situation. It is becoming more and more perilous every day. Those of us who try to live the religious life become more and more sensitive psychically to all influences. And the world psychical atmosphere at present is becoming charged with such foulness and evil that really it is a superhuman task to remain with a mind and a heart that is empty of evil, empty of particularly resentment, fear. Those are two of the most violent forces, greed, and so on. It is becoming increasingly difficult. And yet, there is no way out for us but to use our great instrument of salvation, our power of attentiveness, in terms of perfect mindfulness, in order to be a focus point into which the energy of transcendence can enter freely and operate freely through you, the living organism. This is the very important thing for the religious. This is the way the religious can help the world. And as far as I can see myself, there is no other way which is really an effective and a practical way. A way which can release only good with no side effects like our modern drugs have and so forth. Because, remember, human life means essentially the life of the psyche, the life of the mind. Is it not? Our physical life has its general routine. We have to eat and sleep and work and rest and so on. The simple things which keep our physical life going just like any animal keeps its physical life going, any animal species. We do that. And nature takes care of the whole thing, more or less, unless we descend into the pit of self-indulgence, in which case, of course, the life of the body gets upset. But that is something which goes on. But that doesn't constitute the important part of human life. It does constitute the important part of the lives of millions of people called human beings, but they are strictly subhuman. Just eating, drinking, having fun, as they call it, being with it, as they call it. They are digging their way to the grave in misery. They're only a miserable lot, after all. Seeking for that which is constitutive of them. They are like people who have their ears and their nose and their hands, and they are rushing all over the world to procure a nose and ears and hands. Quite unnecessary. It is there, this happiness. The majority of people are like that. But you and I, who do care for the deeper things and can see the deeper things too, we know that it is the life of the mind, the life of the psyche, which preeminently distinguishes our life as human life. Again and again we have talked about this. Human. Human. The happy creator, which is the description of God. The blissful creator. The action in eternity, which is acausal, which is transcendent, which has no consequence, which has no bondage, which is utter freedom and beauty and perfection. This is the meaning of the word human, from its very derivation, its Sanskrit derivation. That is why through these ages, the great philosophers and the men of religion have said, ye are gods in the making. So now, you and I do see this, at least in some measure, and we care for it. Now, if we are intelligent, we will really be wide awake to this truth, this fact. And we know that transcendence is embodied right within us and is embodied in everything. And insofar as we ourselves become free of all that obstructs the functioning of transcendence, then this invincible, this infinite, eternal power works and brings to fruition in its way, which is immeasurably superior to whatsoever you and I can imagine should be the way. But this, the central point about all this, is the psyche, the mind, the pure mind, the mind which is awake, intelligent, therefore, and it will see the truth of things, of events, of all sense impressions, of persons, of whatsoever happens in our life and comes within the sphere of our conscious experience. Now you see, do we begin to see the tremendous implications of this teaching of mindfulness? Remember, at our summer school, our fundamental subject was mindfulness. But we can have 20 summer schools, 200 summer schools. Oh, we won't live that long. And yet not exhaust the topic of mindfulness. if a Buddha, an enlightened one, through whom transcendence realized itself, and who positively in so many words affirmed the reality of the transcendent, if he said that there is one way, O bhikkhus, by which man may move out of this bondage of sorrow and evil, and it is the way of mindfulness with regard to the body, to the feelings, to the thoughts, and so forth. Remember the great teaching. Jesus put it in just one word, watch. It's a pity that the Gospels never gave some sort of slightly detailed explanation of what you watch. Because the saying was tremendous, watch and pray, for ye know not the hour or the day in which the Son of Man cometh. The Son of Mind, man, man, manas, mind, creation, creative thought, creative action. You see the tremendous implications of the teaching, and yet they never explained it sufficiently. That's a pity. But there we are. Now the Buddha said this about mindfulness, that it is the supreme way, the one and only way, in fact, he called it. So it cannot be of secondary importance. And we must bear in mind too that when he called it the one and only way, he did not imply in that it was a particularized way separate from and to be compared with other ways. This is where the misfortune comes in with enthusiastic followers who are a little bit immature yet, adolescent. And then, you know, you get the arguments and, oh no, yours is the wrong way, this is the right way. That's all nonsense. Cut that out. So we see the importance of mindfulness. The importance of being so wide awake that we do not fall into this trap of self-deception, that we are mindful when we are not really rightly mindful. We must be awake to all the forces right down in the subconscious and in the depths of the unconscious and see them working out. Obviously we can't when we start, or even when we have gone a little way, because one has to go a very long way before all these can be dealt with. Now this is where the other aspect of mindfulness, which takes the shape of discursive meditation, begins to come in. Mindfulness is something to be practiced all day, every day, every moment, all your life, to be awake like that. But the discursive meditation, the specialized sitting quietly, being very still in body, and becoming awake to the stillness of the mind, comes in. Because in that state, the mental sensitivity becomes very much heightened. Now in that state, the hidden devils inside myself begin to come up, and they announce themselves. Greet every one of them. Because those devils represent my potential strength for good. The devil is the one that hurts me, that is against me. My job is to convert him into a friend. He can never be destroyed. The meaning of eternal life, everything lives. Nothing can be annihilated. The Buddha too taught that. Nothing can be annihilated. Everything can be transformed. Therefore, the devil's inside me, who constitute me at the moment. And the stronger and the more terrible they are an extremely good sign that I am really extremely rich in capital. Now, I have to learn the art of using that capital rightly. The fact that there are so many devils and such strong devils means that I have not learned that art, that I'm not using my capital rightly. This is soul strength, don't you see? It is really the strength of your soul within you, of your mind. Your drives, your energy, it's your energy. Now, that devil has to be made a friend. In other words, the particular psychical expression, the mis-expression in me, which is the devil, has to become a right expression, a harmonious expression. And therefore, my task is to see him, recognize him, the devil, and in that process in which I absorb him completely into my being, take him into my heart and understand him, I convert him. We men and women have learned how to tame animals, wild animals. Well, that's exactly what we've got to do with all the devils in us. If we destroy them, there won't be any circus to show for our amusement. So we must tame them. You see, the process, the steps, if I may use that word in this context, the steps of the process. There is first the taming, then there is the training, and then there is the natural, easy, effortless, cooperative dance of life. It's a new way. It isn't really a new way, but it is perhaps a fresh and a healthy way of approaching the whole situation and problem. Very difficult, admittedly very difficult. I would go so far as to say it is the most difficult thing in the world to do. But that is our task. And insofar as we fulfill it, our responsibility in this world to become the pure centers, the pure nexus for the inflow and outflow of transcendent energy comes to fruition.